and then take the subject further from where we were last week. The topic under investigation is presumably a simple one, should be simple, namely, when does the Jewish day change? At what particular point does Shabbat begin? When does Friday afternoon end and Shabbat start? When does Saturday Shabbat end and Motzei Shabbat start? So as we pointed out last time, all societies in which the calendar is basically a lunar calendar, meaning that the month changes with the visibility of the new moon, since the new moon is first visible shortly after the setting of the sun, whenever it does first become visible, that therefore implies, and this is true of all ancient societies with that form of a calendar, that implies that the transition from one day to the next is going to be with sometime around sunset. We today have a convenient, in the secular calendar, transition at midnight because presumably no business is conducted then and people are asleep, but in days in which the new moon establishes the new month, it makes sense to say that the day ends and the new day begins sometime around the setting of the sun. The second point that we made last time is that sunset, that is the onset of twilight, is a continuous phenomenon. And if you go to turn to my page 3, you see a little graph which indicates the change in luminosity as the sun reaches further and further degrees from the zenith. The degrees along the bottom are the angle that the sun is making with the zenith, with directly overhead. So 90 degrees means essentially that the sun is just at the horizon. And as you can see, basically nothing happens during the day until the sun gets to be about 6 degrees above the horizon. The total amount of light is more or less constant the whole day. The light that you have is a combination of direct sunlight and scattered light from the atmosphere, but that combination more or less is constant until about 84 degrees, zenith degrees. Then it becomes sharply decreasing, and there are various stages and degrees of darkness, and then when it reaches something like 18 degrees below the horizon, it becomes completely black. And that is, it gets as dark as it's going to get, ignoring moonlight and various other, and city lights and various other effects. But even several degrees before the 18 degrees below the horizon, it's essentially quite dark. And in civil law and in common practice, having nothing to do with the halacha, usually the regions are divided up. There's a chair here. The regions are divided up as follows, that as long as it's still light enough to do everything, to read, for example, then that period is called civil twilight. Then once civil twilight is passed, it's too dark to read, but you can still make out large objects, or you can make out the shoreline and so on. And that period, from the end of civil twilight until the end of what's known as nautical twilight, that period is called nautical twilight. At the end of nautical twilight, you can't even make out the horizon or sharp or large objects. It's all that dark. But there's still some glow in the sky. So if you were an astronomer and you were looking especially at the western sky, you would still need to get it a little bit darker in order to be able to see the stars of smaller stars. And then once the sun has reached essentially 18 degrees below the horizon, then there's no remaining luminescence in the sky, and that's what's known as the end of astronomical twilight. And now, the problem then becomes how to define within this continuum where the day actually changes. When does Friday end and Shabbat begin within this continuum? And we mentioned 3 out of 4 positions last time, and let me briefly remind you what they are, and we will review the first of them. The first position is that stated by the Ibn Ezra. This is the simplest position, but it contradicts the Talmud. The Ibn Ezra's position, but it's also the position of Rabbi Eliezer Mimitz, because he has a strange reading into the Talmud. This position simply says that sunset is the border. In other words, after the orb of the sun has sunk below the horizon and you can no longer see the sun, then it is legally night. If there is such a thing as Bein HaShemashot, if there is such a thing as twilight, then it's some period before there, and according to this graph, it might be from 84 degrees down to 90 degrees. The Ibn Ezra raises a slight issue as to whether we should calculate sunset geometrically or astronomically, that is, should we calculate it as where the center of the orb of the sun sinks below the tangent plane to the sphere of the earth, which was how the astronomers would define it, or should we give what is known as astronomical sunset, which means that the sun is no longer visible. The difference is because, first of all, the sun has a definite width, and secondly, because of the refraction of light, the light bends a little bit, so you can see the sun even if it's geometrically below the horizon. But that's a minor point in comparison to what we're discussing. Remember, at that stage, it's still sufficiently light to do all activities. So therefore, you would have to say that the legal definition of night has set in, even though in actuality work can continue and so on.
But you could see the moon at that stage, probably.
You could still not see the moon. No, the moon would only become visible when the sun is a few degrees below the horizon. Normally, you would not see the new moon at that stage, at the first period of visibility of the moon. But that doesn't contradict what I was saying earlier, because it's a difference of a few minutes, and the question is just where to draw the line. All right. Then the Talmud lists some astronomical phenomena which are easily explained in terms of things that are happening on the eastern horizon, even though the Talmud then, according to the opinion of Rava, describes something that's happening on the western horizon. And basically what happens is that as the sun sets below the horizon, the shadow of the earth begins to appear on the eastern horizon. I don't know if you've ever seen either a sunrise or a sunset on a clear day. You can even see it here in Boston. I mean, I saw it as recently as a few weeks ago, the phenomenon of sunrise rather than sunset, because on the Mass Pike, the western sky is more visible than anything on the east. But basically what happens is the sun is setting, and then as the sun sets, you'll see a pinkish glow on the eastern horizon. Then as the sun sets further and further below the horizon in the west, the earth itself casts a shadow on the eastern horizon. So you'll see a grayish area below the pink. As the sun is setting down, that grayish area rises, so the pink border moves up and up and up in the sky and eventually disappears. And the second opinion and the third opinion, but let's merge them into two, say that the period of twilight legally begins when the sun sets in the western horizon and lasts until something happens with that pink band. The simplest explanation, or the second explanation of Rabbah, is that it lasts until that pink band disappears. So this is an event that takes place when the sun is something like 4 to 5 degrees below the horizon on the east. Okay? A third...
In the west.
In the west. 4 to 5 degrees below the horizon in the west, this pink band has disappeared in the east, and therefore Bein HaShemashot, the period of doubt, the period of twilight, it begins at the time that the Ibn Ezra says it ends. Then it begins with the setting of the sun and extends until it gets a little dark.
How many minutes did you say it was last time?
Well, it will vary from the season of the year, it will vary in elevation, but it will be somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes approximately, or even less. This is what has technically become known as the Shitata Gaonim, the position of the Gaonim, because of a responsum of Maram Alashkar, which we will go into in a few minutes. All right, all of this is very simple. Also, the Talmud gives a figure for the length of twilight, which it lists as 3/4 mil. So depending upon how long it takes you to walk a mil, and that can vary according to different opinions from 18 minutes to 24 minutes, how that is translated into clock time, the period of 3/4 mil would then be approximately 13 and a half minutes.
When they say mil, does that mean a mile?
Approximately. Approximately.
Figure that out.
Yeah, approximately. But remember, it's not distance that we're measuring, it's time.
Time.
And therefore, 3/4 mil, the longest value for it is 18 minutes, and the shortest value for it is 13 and a half minutes. To fix the discussion, because this is, again, not relevant too much, let's take the 13 and a half minute figure, for simplicity. Okay, so this period of twilight is 13 and a half minutes, and therefore it doesn't jive with what I just said before of 20 or 30 minutes, but maybe it starts a little bit later, this time of sunset. At any rate, it's a short period of time. The problem is that the Gemara and Psachim, in a discussion that is not concerned with a particularly legal question, says that the time from Shkiyat HaChama, from sunset, until Tzeit HaKochavim, that is, until the time that the stars appear, is 4 mil. So instead of this being 13 and a half minutes, it's going to be 72 minutes.
4 times 18.
Yeah, 4 times 18 is 72, an hour and 12 minutes, not 13 minutes. That's a big difference. So how does the simplest way of interpreting this discrepancy is to say that the Gemara in Pesachim, if we like on our graph, is talking about a different twilight, not a halachic twilight, but how long it takes to get so dark that you can't do anything. So that therefore, maybe they were even talking about astronomical twilight. If you took astronomical twilight is 18 degrees below the horizon, and if you were standing on the equator at the spring or the fall equinox, it would take you exactly 72 minutes for the sun to reach that period. In other words, the simplest interpretation, the simplest way of dealing with the discrepancy between the Gemara in Shabbat, which deals with a legal issue, and the Gemara in Pesachim, which is telling you a story, is to ignore the Gemara in Pesachim. Say that it's simply referring to a different event, not to an event that has any legal consequences.
So the story had nothing to do with Shkia?
It had. The Gemara says that it takes, from the text that you read, that from the time of Shkia until Tzeit HaKochavim is 72 minutes. 72 is a lot more than 13 and a half. And we don't have to deal with this, really. It's just a contradiction between two texts, and we would simply deal with this by saying that the Talmud in Pesachim, which gives you the 72-minute figure, is talking about something like astronomical twilight, but has no legal consequences. Shabbat has begun long before then, or Shabbat has departed long before then. The 72 minutes refers to the time that it takes to get so dark that you can't do anything, or even so dark that you can't see any glow on the western horizon. But that's not how Rabbeinu Tam explains this. And this is the beginning. So Rabbeinu Tam, and let's reread what Rabbeinu Tam says. This is 17. Rabbeinu Tam says that we read this last time, but this is a good place to start by reading this again. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Mishkiyat HaChama Ad Tzeit HaKochavim Arba Milim. You have that? On the bottom of my page 17. This is a Tosfot on Pesachim. Koshel Rabbeinu Tam. Debesof Baden Madlikin Shabbat Lamedalet Amar Ezehu Bein Hashmashot Mishetishka HaChama Kol Zman Shepnei Mizrach Madivim Radivei Ri Masayim Maskinan Hatam Debein Hashmashot to Rabbi Yehuda Tlati Rivei Mil. That the length, the duration of twilight, as far as Rabbi Yehuda was concerned, was 3/4 mil, in other words, 13 and a half minutes. V'hachal ka'ama uchi gufei, the same Rabbi Yehuda himself says here that it's 4 mil. V'yesh lomar, the hachal ka'ama, mitchilat shkia, from the beginning of the sunset, דהיינו משעה שמתחלת החמה להיכנס בעובי הרקיע עד הלילה הביא ארבע מילים. והתם כאמר מסוף שקיע. So Rabbeinu Tam is introducing a new theory that the Talmud in Psachim is talking about the beginning of the sunset, when the sun begins to enter the firmament, and the Tal Gemara in Shabbat is talking about the end of this lengthy procedure of sunset, when the sun has managed to emerge on the other side of the firmament. What is this? So in order to understand this theory, we have to go back and briefly look on my page 14. Chachmei Yisrael Omrim. This is a famous quotation, and we will have some various things to say about it. Chachmei Yisrael Omrim. Bayom chama mahalechet lamata meharakia. During the day, the sun travels below the firmament. Uvalayla lamala meharakia. And at night, it's going back above the firmament. Vachachmei umot haolam omrim, and the Gentile scholars say, Bayom chama mahalechet lamata meharakia, that the sun goes below the firmament during the day. Uvalayla lamata meharakia. And during the night, it goes underneath the earth and comes back up the other side. Amar Rabbi, v'nirin divrehem midvarenu, shebiyom ma'ayanot sonunim uvalayla rotchit. So Rabbi gives a very false argument as to why the Gentile scholars are right, but I want to concentrate for a moment on this strange theory that the Chachmei Yisrael have proposed and see if we can find any cognates for it. But let's understand what Rabbeinu Tam is saying. Rabbeinu Tam is taking this theory of Chachmei Yisrael seriously. He's saying that this is a real cosmological theory, a real theory, namely that you have a firmament up there, and that this firmament is thick, and the sun has to travel through the firmament, and that's why there are two different usages of the word Shkia. The beginning of the Shkia is when the sun enters the firmament. Presumably, that's what the Gemara in Psachim is talking about. And presumably, that's when the sun is no longer visible to us because it's entered into the thickness of the firmament. In other words, when the sun has set below the horizon. And then it takes a while to work its way through the firmament, and then it comes up the other side. Yes.
Do they have the astronomical facts right, that the sun, the earth is going around the sun? Do they have a geometrical picture?
Who is they?
Whoever at this stage,
you have a dispute between legitimate astronomers, which was then represented by Ptolemaic astronomy, which said that the sun and the various planets and the fixed stars were all on spheres which were rotating about various epicycles and what have you, but basically the spheres were all rotating around the Earth, going from east to west, and therefore all of the celestial objects follow the motion of the sphere and rotate and go under the Earth at night and come back the other side the next day. We interpret that by saying that the Earth is rotating on its axis and the heavens are fixed. But from the point of view of description, at this stage, it doesn't matter which picture you use. It's only when you want to get a more precise description of the motion of the planets that the Ptolemaic system fails and one has to replace it with the Copernican system and so on. But so the position that the Talmud attributes to the Chachmei Umot Olam is a simple statement in Ptolemaic astronomy. And it holds just as good today as it did 2,000 years ago or whatever. The fine-tuning comes when you want to be more accurate about the motion of Mars, for example. But this is, from the point of view at the level of which we're discussing, this is a standard, it's irrelevant, and this is the standard theory.
Did the Rabbanim don't think the same thing?
No, but the rabbis had a different picture. The rabbis had what seems to us to be a very weird picture, namely that there is a firmament stretched over the sky, and the sun makes its way through this firmament at the end of the day, and then goes back over the firmament, comes back down the other side, and then tunnels through in the morning. Okay?
And that's why there's twilight, because you get much
and
less.
And there's twilight because as the sun is going through the tunnel, less and less of its light becomes apparent, and then eventually when it comes to the other side and then gets on the top of the firmament and is away from the hole, it doesn't send any light through this tunnel.
Is the Earth stationary at this point?
The Earth is stationary.
In either one.
In either picture, the Earth is stationary, but what you should ask is, what is the shape of the Earth? That's another question that has to come into this consideration. Okay?
That's like a klipa, like the firmament is like something.
The firmament is
an orange skin or something like that. That's okay. Penetrate through.
Now, for many years, I was puzzled as to where is there any cognate whatsoever of this strange theory. It doesn't represent any known scientific theory. And in fact, I asked Zvi about that, and if you notice that Professor Pinas refers to Zvi in the selection that you have a handout of, and we will see that in a moment. No, this is not Babylonians and the Egyptians. This is something that has to do with a religious controversy. And first of all, let's take a look at another bit of theory that we see here. Before we go into the details, let me tell you where I'm going in the next 15 minutes. Okay? There's a strange theory here, which has no scientific basis whatsoever, but is a theory. Wherever this theory comes from, and we'll see cognates of it in the Sefer Yetzirah and in a strange book called Christian Topography, this theory existed. It was a theory which was basically a conflict between scripture and science. So the notion that there's a fight between religion and science only in the 19th century or only at the time of Galileo, this is a much earlier conflict, and we'll see there's some pretty strong language associated with it. But on this conflict between a scriptural view of the cosmology and the scientific view of cosmology as represented by Ptolemaic astronomy, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi says, they're right and we're wrong. The astronomers are right, and the people who are deriving a picture of the cosmos from a different source are wrong. Okay? But what is Rabbeinu Tam doing? Rabbeinu Tam is resurrecting this strange theory, whose cognates I will explain, even though the Gemara says that the Ptolemaic astronomers are right and the rabbis are wrong on this point. Rabbeinu Tam, and I'll read to you, I quoted him in English, but let me read to you what he says. He says that the Shishita Mikabetzes quotes the name of Rabbeinu Tam.
It's in
Tubot. I forgot to put down Tubot. It's in Shishita Mikabetzes, Tubot 13b. I quoted it in English just above, this, on page 17, just above, I forgot to say Tubot, okay? It says that, in the name of Rabbeinu Tam, B'afal gav denitzchu chachmei umot ha'olam l'chachmei Yisrael, even though the Gentile scholars defeated the Jewish scholars on this matter, haynu nitzachon b'ta'anot, they won the argument. That is, as a matter of rhetoric, they won the argument. Aval ha'emet hi k'chachmei Yisrael. The truth of the matter is that the structure of the cosmos is, as the Jewish scholars said, v'hainu v'amrinan b'tfilah, that's as we say in the prayer, u'bokeya chalonei rokiya. When we say Bokeya Chalonei Rakia, that means that the Rakia has a chalon, and that the sun is coming through the chalon, it breaks through a window in the firmament, and so on. So Rabbeinu Tam says that it's that certainly the Jewish position could not have been wrong on this matter. If there happened to have been a dispute between the astronomers and the rabbis, well, the astronomers may have won the argument, but the truth really is with the rabbis. And therefore, since the truth is with the rabbis, that there is this firmament and there's this thick thing and so on, we can now explain the discrepancy between the Gemara in Pesachim and the Gemara in Shabbat by saying that there are two forms of Shkia. There's the initial sunset, when the sun enters the firmament. That's when it's no longer visible on the western horizon. And then it tunnels its way through and is about to come up the other side when it manages to move past this tunnel in the firmament and move around the other side. That's when night has completely formed. And that takes four. Okay? And therefore, the Gemara in Shabbat, which gives you the figure of 13 and a half minutes, is talking about an event that is occurring at the end of this 72-minute process.
I went on the other side to have any life anymore from Rabbi Natan.
What?
In this theory, once it has gone through the tunnel,
right?
Why is there any light? Once it's
no, it moves up. It's no longer...
But it's blocked by the Rukia.
Yeah.
So therefore, how does any light come through?
No light comes through.
Therefore, so what is the meaning of that? 13,
That's when it's moving, when it's coming out the other end. It has to move up.
It has to, it's the duration as it goes, as it comes up the hole.
That's right. As it's coming out of the tunnel, going up the hole, and coming around the other side, a little bit of light still is coming through, and then when it's above the hole and no light is shining through that tunnel, then it's completely night.
I'm going to believe in a flat earth.
All right. Yeah, you have to believe in a flat earth. Okay, so now let's
where's the sun go at?
Just a moment. Let's see this flat earth business. To see the flat earth business, let's turn back to my page, I guess 14. Okay. All right. So this is a weird cosmological position. All right. And I want to just check some of its cognates to see what it's coming out of, but it has seemingly a drastic halakhic consequence. The drastic halakhic consequence is that this whole transition between day and night is starting 58 and a half minutes after the setting of the sun. Startling. In other words, according to Rabbeinu Tam, Bein HaShemashot only begins 58 and a half minutes after sunset. Based on this weird cosmological theory. Now let's take a look.
It begins.
Begins.
It only lasts for how long?
13 and a half minutes.
So
right. In other words, you go and look and see where is, you get your U.S. nautical almanac, which I Xeroxed some portions of, but everyone presumably has a copy in his back pocket of the U.S. nautical almanac. You look and see when is the sunset at that day. Or you can look on the TV weather channel and see what it lists a sunset today is 6:14 or something like that. And then you wait 58 and a half minutes, and up until that time, it's still definitely daytime, according to this position. So the consequences are seemingly startling. All right? And the function of the shiur today is to trace what the consequences of that position were and are, and see what happened to it, but I want to spend 10 or 15 minutes just tracing the genealogy of this strange theory. Okay? So the Gemara in Bahar Batra says, Tanya Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Olam ki asat ki achsadra. Olam ki liachsadra hudomeh. That the earth is like a porch. Right? Exedra means outside, the front porch. In other words, you had something which is sort of covered on three out of four sides. The fourth side is open to the outer doors. So you should imagine a porch which is enclosed for three walls, but the wall with the steps leading to the courtyard is open. Okay? Once the sun reaches the northwestern corner of its travel, nichfefet, bends down, va'ola lamala min harakia, and it returns over the firmament, like we just described. Rav Yehoshua omer, olam lukubah udome, that the earth is like a vaulted room, that is, a room with a vault over it, okay? Beruach tzonet mesuchach vehet, that the fourth wall, the northern wall of the earth, is also completely enclosed. The kevan she'achama magarat lekeren maravit tzfonit, makefet v'chozeret acharei kipa. It reaches the northwestern point, and then it comes back behind the northern wall. Instead of coming back overhead, it makes a detour around the North Pole and comes back. Okay? So the picture here is that you have a rectangular room, a flat earth rectangular room. The only dispute is whether the northern border is or is not closed. Kuba means vaulted room. Okay. Now, to see that this is not, and of course the Talmud brings proof of this, for example, from the passage in Iyov, min acheder tavo sufa u'mimezarim kara. In other words, the earth is shaped like a room, because that's what it says in the passage in Iyov. The passage in Iyov is a beautiful passage. It's just before the time when God appears out of the whirlwind to tell Job the answers to all of his questions, or non-answers to all of his questions, as your interpretation may be. But the fact is that they are drawing a picture of the cosmos on the basis of what it says in Eo. Okay? Now, as an analogy, let's see on my page 11 of the supplement. So it's going to be page 338 of the Christian Topography. Cosmos is a Christian writer from about the 5th century. We can see a little bit of him described in the Christian Topography, written in Greek, apparently between 547 and 549. So he was a merchant of Alexandria. Okay?
By the way, they don't seem to notice that the sun is in different points on the traverses different space circles.
Yeah, they do. They notice that because okay. But now. First, let's go to my page 8, which is 320, a couple of pages before that. My page 8. Okay? So, his number 17. Having thus founded the earth, which is oblong on its own basis, God attached to the extremities of the heavens to the extremities of the earth. On the bottom, or according to along the four sides, he attaches the extremities of the heaven. In the upper part, on the other hand, he rounds it out like a vault, having a very large altitude. Okay, so you have a picture of an oblong earth, rectangular earth, with a vault over it, and vertical walls at the ends. Okay, let's go to now to page 11, his page 338. So his number 34. Things being what they are, we say then in conformity to the divine scripture that the sun leaves the east, travels along the sky of the meridian regions lifts and sends its light towards the north and on along the whole inhabited earth. According to Cosmos, the earth is on a little bit of a tilt, that is, the mountains go up so that the northern portion of the earth has a higher elevation than the southern portion of the earth, and therefore when the sun makes its nightly rounds from the north back to the east, it's blocked by the earth as well as the screen of the sun. Okay? Now let's go to the next page.
It's a combination. It's partly under the earth.
Partly under the earth and partly on the other side of the screen. Okay? Let's go to my next page, 17, or whatever it is, 12, I guess. But his page, the next page from that, number one. After the flood, do we all have that? Book three.
Number two.
That the divine scripture is sure and deserving of belief, that it explains things which are concordant with it and with the entirety, both the Old and the New Testaments, and indicates the utility of the various forms of the universe. But now he's going to discuss this heretical idea about the sphericity of the earth and the the invention and the spread of the pretended sphericity of the heaven, the Tower of Babel. That's the heading of this section. You reading it in Greek, Jonathan? After the flood, about the time of the construction of the tower, which was an act of defiance against God, when the men, having reached a large, high altitude, put themselves to observe the stars in the following fashion, they had for the first time induced themselves into the error and conceived vaguely the idea, namely, that the sky is spherical. And like the city where they erected a tower was near the Babylonians, this invention first appeared necessarily amongst the Chaldeans, who had, starting from that, elaborated this barbaric theory of the sphere. Then the race of Abraham, of Chaldean origin, having descended into Egypt, transmitted this to the Egyptians, this particular idea. The Egyptians were impressed on their part to make that this their point of departure, and propagated this idea until the Greeks, having passed through Egypt, and the philosophers Pythagoras, Plato, Eudoxus, etc., learned about this and therefore developed it further, taking the point of departure of these first inventions. In other words, this whole theory of the sphericity of the earth and the sphericity of the heaven was a crime committed originally at the time of the Tower of Babel, transmitted to these heretical Babylonian astronomers, and then Abraham passed the idea down into Egypt, and the Greeks passing through got these ideas from that. In other words, what one is dealing with here is a pure religious controversy. On the one hand, the scriptures indicate very clearly that the earth is oblong, not very clearly, but as far as he is concerned, that's what's indicated, and therefore there's a religious confrontation between belief in the scriptures on the one hand and belief in the scientific evidence on the other, and clearly the scientific evidence should be condemned as being heretical and a consequence of man's hubris associated with the erection of the Tower of Babel. So I'm pointing out that this theory that we find in the Talmud is not restricted to the Talmud, but was apparently part of some kind of religious conflict between a literal interpretation of scripture and the current scientific dogma of the Pythagorean theorem, that the Ptolemaic theory that the earth was spherical.
But this is coming hundreds of years, this particular book, hundreds of years later,
well,
then the Talmudic than Rebbe.
It's coming a couple of hundred years later than Rebbe, but we just don't know whether the report that's in the Talmud is an accurate transmission of something that Rebbe said or was some later development that we don't know. But yeah, it was in the air. And there's an even later development in the Sefer Hasidim, which is also in the Sefer HaYetzirah. That's also very interesting. Okay? So go to my page 34, 35, and thereabouts. This is an extract from an essay that Professor Pinas wrote on the Sefer Yetzirah. He makes a number of fascinating comments on it, but let's take a look at the quotation where now, if somebody should say to our, this is Saadia's commentary on page 164 near the bottom. If someone should say to our mind, it seems as though the author works over the earth and the heaven are square, and that there's no heaven beneath the earth, two opinions that are not in accord with what is believed by men of knowledge, we shall answer it is possible that what he said was intended to use as an example rather than to make a statement about the true reality, etc., etc. So Rabbi Saadia Gaon is trying to jibe the implications in the Sefer Yetzirah also that the earth is flat and square with the known spherical character of the earth and the spherical character of the sky. If we go to his page of 166 or 135, the next page, my page 35.
He says something sounds like photons, doesn't it? That we see is composed of small, square, very compact particles,
mm-hmm.
even circles. And
right. So that's part of the Aristotelian theories. Okay, the opinion favored by the great mass of our people is that the heavenly sphere and the earth are both of them spherical, that the earth inside the heaven is like unto a point, and that the circular movement of the sun takes place during the day above the earth and the night beneath it. I mean, that's the standard Ptolemaic theory, including the fact that the earth is a sphere. This opinion was also mentioned by the ancient rabbis, where they said the sages of the Gentiles say the sun moves during the day above the earth and at night beneath it. And they said that rabbi said what they say seems preferable to what he said. At this point, Sadia remarks, nevertheless, many of them profess the opinion of the author of this book. He points out that there is an opinion in the Talmud, which we have just seen, which has a flat earth and a vault over it. Okay? So, and then you can read it yourselves, it's in English. Professor Pinas goes into discussion of the fact that this is indeed the position of the Christian typography, and he quotes the sections that we just read. And in note 21, he mentions a manuscript that Zvi discovered and analyzed. I had an email correspondence with Zvi about this recently, but I've been discussing this with him for the past 20 or 25 years. So it's not a new topic. Okay. Fine. So, we're now in the following situation. There was some sort of a conflict between science and religion as to the shape of the earth. The Gemara, in the name of Rebbe, simply is willing to accept the scientific evidence. The Sefer Yetzirah is willing to support the non-scientific evidence. But what is now strange is that Rabbeinu Tam tries to resurrect this theory of the vault shape of the sky and the sun moving over the heavens back in the other direction at night, and to use that to resolve this conflict between the Talmud, between the Gemara and the Gemara in Shabbat, which gives a 13 and a half minute period, and the okay. All right. So Rabbeinu Tam was presumably not educated in science, and therefore was willing to accept the opinion of the Chachmei Yisrael in order to resolve a conflict between two texts. And as we will see now in a moment, Rabbeinu Ephraim, Rabbeinu Eliezer Mimitz, who was Rabbeinu Tam's student, also accepts this theory, but just has an entirely different explanation of how what's happening at night. We'll read Rabbeinu Eliezer Mimitz in a moment. Two things are mind-boggling to me in all of this. This is not the most shocking thing that we're going to say this evening, but a mind-boggling thing to me is that in the 19th century, Rabbi Akiva Eger quotes at length, and therefore seemingly provably, this statement of Rabbeinu Tam. So, after the Copernican Revolution, after the existence of modern science, someone, a major rabbi of the 19th century living in Eastern Europe, what? I don't know. When I gave my talk on biology in Haifa, and I mentioned this crazy idea of Mishtana HaTeva, there was one student who came to me after my lecture and said that he was the student at Merkaz HaRav, in the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva, and he mentions to his teacher that Rashi somewhere says that the earth is flat. How's that possible? Because we know that the earth is spherical, and says Rosh Yeshiva told him, well, Mishtana HaTeva. The earth has changed its shape from the time of Rashi until the present. Then he went to Rav Nevensal in the old city, and Rav Nevensal pointed out to him